Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Hello there. Nice to see you. I'm standing between you and lunch, so we'll see how we get on. I'll try and keep the presentation as rapid as possible so that you have plenty of time for questions. So we're Frontier Developments. Here's what we're going to go through today. I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of us. We're going to talk about the industry, our history, our business model, our financials, our peers, which I think is helpful for you guys to understand how we fit into the kind of gaming universe, our future, and then we'll move to questions. So Frontier, who are we, what are we? So we've been around for 25 years. In January, we'll celebrate our 25th anniversary. And for about 20 of those years, we've been in the work for hire space. We've been very successful in there, essentially developing games for publishers who would then release those games. And essentially, we would be receiving development fees during that development process. With the rise of digital distribution, in other words, people buying games digitally, that unlocked the potential for us to transition to a different model, which we call self-publishing. So we take the financial risks ourselves, we develop a game, we launch it ourselves. And we now have three game franchises out there, Elite Dangerous, Planet Coaster, and Jurassic World Evolution. And we're scaling up to deliver roughly one launch per year. So far we've been doing one every 2 years, and we're growing to have one every 12 months or so. This is the games industry. So just a few highlights. It's big and it's growing. It's actually the biggest sector within the entertainment industry, well over a third of the total entertainment industry. That's bigger than film, it's bigger than TV, it's bigger than music. And I think probably you guys all are aware of that. And it's growing. It's growing at about 14%, depending on which bit of research you look at. So it's already big, it's already growing, and it's really founded on innovation and change. So if you look at the games coming out of arcades, going onto different platforms, going onto PCs, different controllers, joysticks, the Wii controller, different experiences like augmented reality, virtual reality, the rise of mobile games, things like Pokemon Go. It's always been a business, it's always been an industry which has a lot of change and innovation, and we're at the forefront of that. The four sectors are PC, console, mobile and tablet, and we tend to focus on the PC and the console sectors. Those sectors tend to be fairly sticky. They tend to have very high quality bars, and you want to get a customer to buy that game, a player to buy that game, and to play for many hours. Very different to mobile, where it tends to be very low barrier to entry, but it's a very fickle market. People will be playing for a relatively short period of time. Lots of games out there, but the quality bar is fairly low. So we like to stick with the high quality sector of PC and of console. And the market does continue to change. We're still seeing that transition to digital, which is still ongoing. And we see new opportunities arising from that. If you look at China, that's another arising opportunity for us. Just have a quick look at the games industry and how that's changed. So 10 years ago, it was really still dominated, particularly on console, by physical disc. So lots of power, lots of control held within the retail and distribution channel, lots of power held with publishers. So in that time, going for a self-published model as a developer, very risky. You're having to put a lot of financial investment upfront into discs, and the margins tend to be on the low side. So it wasn't really possible to transition. Games market today, it's much more about digital. If you look at a platform like PC, Steam tends to be very dominant. There are other platforms as well, but a lot of people on PC, pretty much almost 100% of people on PC are now buying digitally. On console, it's probably 50-50. And that transition to digital unlocks a really interesting opportunity for us. And we've taken that, and that's enabled us to grow and extend our portfolio. So this is a little bit more on our history. So over those three decades, we were founded by David Braben, and then over time built a team around him, and then eventually founded the company in 1994. And as I said, we're 25 years old. And we had a great deal of success during that 20-year, that initial 20-year period of time as a work for hire developer. So we'd work with publishers like Microsoft, making some of these games here. But the financial returns tend to be lower, you know, margins 10 to 15%. And inherently, although you might have a contract where you know you're going to get paid for the work that you do, it doesn't necessarily mean that you will get paid. So there's still quite a lot of financial risk in that model, particularly on the publisher side. So transition to self-publishing. So we began this process around 2012, 2013. We did a Kickstarter funding for Elite Dangerous, which was a major reboot on the Elite franchise, which David had, had originally created. We followed that up with further funding through an IPO, and then we launched our first self-published title, Elite Dangerous, in 2014. And that has allowed us to continue to then expand on that, to add to that portfolio. We look after and we love Elite, but it allows us to move on to other game titles like Planet Coaster. In terms of where we're based, we needed to add some marketing and customer support. So we needed to grow not just in development, but in other functions as well. And we now have just over 400 people. And we're based in Cambridge. This is our lovely new shiny building that we moved into in April in the Science Park. And we've got plenty of expansion space there, at least for the next 3 years. And we continue to grow quite aggressively in terms of headcount, probably about 60 people per year right now. So if you haven't seen them, I encourage you to go and have a look at videos of our games. Even better if you buy the game and play the game. It's a great way to do some investment research, and it's good for us as well. So I'm not going to show you today videos because this room's quite hot and small, and we'll move on to other things. But Elite Dangerous launched in December 2014. It's an amazing, expansive space simulation game. You can explore, you can be a pirate, you can help other players, you can trade, you can play the game as you like it, and that's proved incredibly popular and has generated very nice revenue for us over its first four years, and we're now in the fifth year of Elite Dangerous. Planet Coaster launched in November 2016, and this is a spiritual a successor to Roller Coaster Tycoon 3, which was a game that we made in the work for hire model. Fantastic roller coaster park simulation game, which has again proved incredibly popular. And actually then our biggest launch to date has been Jurassic World Evolution, which launched in June of this year. And you know, you can see plenty of footage of that. It's a really interesting, creative dinosaur park creation management game. So a little bit more on the game franchise, because we talk about game franchise, what does that really mean? And it means different things to different people. If you look at people like EA, Activision, Take-Two, their approach to game franchises tends to be to try and generate about $1 billion of annual sales per year. And they create these massive franchises, which then they would cycle over several years, maybe have a major sequel, major reboot every now and again. So they're investing very big for a massive kind of a weekend launch, as you've just seen probably with something like Call of Duty Black Ops or Red Dead Redemption. They're looking for that massive success in the opening weekend. We too are looking for strong launch revenues, but where we differ is we have a more of a sustain and nurture phase following that launch, and that means that we can generate multi-year revenues as we love and look after that game. We provide free content, we provide paid for content, we support the community. And that means we can generate cash over very many years as we support that game and we support the community. So this chart is cumulative cash flow for Planet Coaster. So this is about a 2 year cycle, and we continue to invest. And actually, as we go through the project, we ramp up from initially a very small team, maybe 10 or 20 people, ramping up to probably 100 people. And by the time we launch here in November 2016, we've probably spent in total, including marketing spend, 7 to 8 million, maybe £7.5 million of total investment in Planet Coaster at that point. And you can see very, very quickly, we get our money back and then we start to generate very nice returns. And the success of the cash flow from this point on, the kind of slope of that curve, depends on how we support that game, how we support it in terms of being active with the community of players that we've created, the free content that we provide, the paid for content we provide, and also price promotions, which are very effective. So you can see this little spike up here. This is kind of Thanksgiving, Christmas, about a year after launch. And when we put it on price promotion, that attracts a whole new audience who are very price conscious. They buy the game, hopefully they buy some of the PDLC, so the paid downloadable content, and that keeps our cash flow going, allows us to continue to invest. So this is our approach to a game franchise. It's a launch phase followed by this sustain and nurture kind of phase. So as I said, we're building up this franchise portfolio. We already have Elite Dangerous, Planet Coaster, and Jurassic World. And we will always seek out areas where we think we can be successful over the long term. So we're not looking necessarily to do some copycat thing, because a lot of people will tend to do that. If you look at a game like Fortnite, you know, we're probably a bit crazy to try and compete against games like Fortnite, PUBG, Call of Duty. So we will pick areas of the market where we think we can do a great job. And crucially, unlike some of the major studios, like some of those US companies, because we're not investing hundreds of millions of dollars, we don't need a mega hit of 10, 15, 20 million units. Our break even is quite low. Our break even is probably a few hundred thousand units. And that means a mega hit for us is actually probably a million units in the first 6 months, maybe 2 million units a year would be fantastic. And as you've seen with Jurassic, we've done a million units in 5 weeks. So in our terms, it is a massive success, a massive hit. In terms of looking at, say, Red Dead Redemption 2, which probably did over 20 million units in the first weekend, of course it's much smaller. But this is our approach, this is our model, and we think over time, as we step up and build on our franchise portfolio, that generates very nice revenue growth and earnings growth as well. So where are we with future launches? So we've already confirmed that our fourth franchise will be in the next financial year. So that's any time between June 2019 and May 2020. And that will be based on our own IP. And we'll provide more details as and when we can. I'll touch on that point a little bit. And we will have probably a mix of games which use our IP and external IP as we move forward with the portfolio. So this is a bit of an illustration of how we see the scale up. It's a bit of an eye chart. These are financial years going across the bottom. The dark blue is a launch. The light blue is the sustain and nurture phase. And the white boxes are when something's in development. So you can see in financial year 15, we launched Elite Dangerous. We generated 19 million of self-published revenue. Actually, it did slightly stronger numbers in the second year. It did £21 million in that second year. In financial year 17, we launched Planet Coaster, and that saw us step up the revenues to 36 million. And then financial year 18, we didn't have a franchise launch, but we still managed to achieve 33 million. So you can see we tend to have these step ups in revenue as we have a launch. And then the second year does tend to be lower. Elite Dangerous, a little bit unusual. What we're seeing for this financial year, so we're in financial year 19, is we have the launch of Jurassic World Evolution. And if you look at the analyst numbers, they're expecting about £80 million, which is roughly split between about £60 million from Jurassic World Evolution and about £20 million from Elite Dangerous and Planet Coaster combined. Then in financial year 20, analysts have us, as I said, announcing and releasing Franchise 4 in that financial year. The reason they have a lower number is because I think quite sensibly and prudently, they're assuming that that Franchise 4 probably won't be quite as strong in terms of the launch revenues as Jurassic World Evolution, which is obviously achieving the peaks of the revenue this year. So just turning that into a chart to see how that looks, looking backwards and looking forwards a little bit further. This is revenue from financial year 12 up to financial year 2022. The grey bits are work for hire revenues. And you can see, you know, we're doing well here, but only generating sort of 10 to 15 million pounds of sales. That transition to self-publishing sees us grow the revenue up to in the mid 30s. We then see in financial year the launch of Jurassic World Evolution, which propels us upwards. As I said, I think quite sensibly analysts are assuming that in financial year 20, the fourth franchise probably won't be quite as strong a launch in terms of initial sales. But from then on, we're moving to one launch per year and we're starting to grow the business. And it's quite an important point to make, because we are about the long term. You know, this is a long term play. We're building a portfolio which we think is going to generate strong returns, not just in this year, but in next year and beyond. We could have easily launched Jurassic World at the end of last financial year, smoothed out these revenue bars. But that would have been a crazy thing to do because the film was coming out in June. So to launch the game maybe a month before the film wouldn't have made any commercial sense. So it's just a point I want to get across to you guys is we will do things for the long term. If we can do something here to kind of fill in this slight revenue hole and it works for the long term, of course we'll do it. But we're not going to rush to kind of pull launches in to move things about to do something short term, which ultimately doesn't benefit the long term because we are a long term story. One thing I thought would be helpful is to run through our income statement, because I know that some of you guys like to kind of model different scenarios and try and work out, you know, if we sell this, we'll do that. If we sell that, we'll do the other number. So I thought I'd speed down our income statement and kind of give you a few tips and clues. So on revenue, when you're modeling that number, don't forget to take off sales tax, because often what people do is they say, oh, the retail price is this. I multiply it by the unit. So first of all, take off sales tax. In the US, that tends to average about 10%. Obviously in the UK, it's 20%. On physical sales, we account for those slightly differently because we record the wholesale price. So the price that's going into the retail and distribution channel, because we don't have control of that retail price. We have to do a recommended price and we only recognize the wholesale price. So when you're trying to do the modeling of the revenue, just bear that in mind. The other thing which is very important is that price promotions are an extremely effective sales tool. So don't assume that for the full year, we're going to be always having Jurassic, for example, at the full price that you would tend to see. It's just gone on discount price promotion for Thanksgiving, for Black Friday, for instance. So you need to take that into account if you're working out your average price and trying to model what the revenue looks like. And you know, have a look at the analyst note, who doesn't actually provide too much detail in here. But the FinCap stuff is publicly available. You can get the FinCap research free as well. On cost of sales, we tend to have digital and physical distribution costs. So digital costs are things like the Steam margin, the Xbox margin, the PlayStation margin, where we're paying them a certain proportion of the revenue, and that tends to be around 30%. Obviously, with the Universal license for Jurassic, we obviously have IP as well, and that goes within cost of sales. So the gross margin tends to track around to around about 70% for digital sales, excluding those license costs. And so for this year, as you'll see with the analyst notes, they're assuming the overall blended margin will be kind of low 60s, depending on which analyst report you look at. Then moving through the cost line. So I think it's important on the R&D to understand how the accounting works. So we have gross R&D, which is like cash outflow, so pretty much payroll costs with some outsourcing. So the gross R&D number, which I always state in the commentary, it's not in the income statement itself, tends to be in the presentation, but have a look in the commentary. And that gives you a clue as to the kind of trajectory of where we're going with the actual R&D spend. Then we will capitalize a pretty big chunk of that, because anything relating to new chargeable content, we will capitalize. So a new game development, a new bit of PDLC, we will capitalize those costs. So then you take those out. Typically, that's in the sort of 60 to 80% sort of bracket if you look at it as a percentage of gross R&D. Amortization, we tend to use a four-year period for game assets. So we write off over 4 years. And for PDLC, we tend to do 2 years, which is pretty prudent, actually. If you look at someone like Codemasters, they tend to write it off in a year, but that's because they have a Formula One launch every year. So it depends on the company. For us, if you look at Elite, it's still going extremely strongly in its fifth year. So this kind of 4-2 year thing makes a huge amount of sense for us. So once you've started with the gross R&D, taken off capitalized costs, add back amortization, you get the net R&D that you see within the account. So again, if you're modeling this, I encourage you to maybe not use a revenue percentage to work out the numbers, but to actually kind of make some judgments on where you think the growth rates are going to be and what we're going to capitalize and what we're going to amortize. Sales and marketing tends to be driven by launch activity, but obviously ongoing digital marketing, particularly on games as well. So that is one you could model on revenue. You know, 10 to 15%, I think, is a reasonable number. And then G&A, that tends to be all our facilities costs, admin, the value-adding finance people, support functions, company bonus is within there. And that's one to take into account as well, because that is a factor of profit determined by the profit number. And share charges and exchange. And that gives you operating profit. We don't tend to report lots of different profit measures. I think it's much better just to stick with the proper IFRS operating profit number, and then you can move it and adjust it as you see fit. But we also do disclose an operating cash flow, which is essentially like a cash profit number, because it unwinds this bit of accounting, and it also unwinds things like share charges. So if you want to look at sort of free cash flow type of measures, the operating cash flow that we disclose is quite helpful for that. And on tax, you know, no tax to account for yet, because actually we've got some decent tax losses, which we'll be talking about when we do the next set of results. So sorry if that was a bit boring, but I thought it was helpful to give you a little bit of a steer on the income statement so that you can try and understand the numbers. This is a table we normally show to highlight the other players within the game sector. I think we've talked quite a lot about the big guys here who are doing these mega franchises, investing a lot, placing big bets, and actually generating very good returns and producing amazing content. The UK companies who are listed now tend to be towards the bottom of this list. I think partly because the US companies keep buying the small independent studios, which is kind of frustrating. But I do encourage you to have a look at other games companies as well if you're interested in this sector. I've tried to underline and highlight here the difference between us, between the five companies. So Frontier, we consider ourselves a developer and publisher. Actually, Codemasters is very much the same, a developer and publisher in a certain, you know, they're very focused on racing games. Keywords is more of a technical services provider. So they've bought up a lot of companies that provide services to the games industry, including recently they bought a development studio. Sumo are more focused on being an independent video game developer. So that is us in that work for hire model, providing services to the big publishers, developing games for those publishers. And then Team 17 is an interesting one because they're really good at working with independent studios, finding these real amazing nuggets of good games and pushing those forward and developing those and hoping those are successful. So five quite different companies with different models. Don't just buy one, buy them all. So future opportunities. Our core model will always be to use our internal expertise, our internal resources, our amazing people to develop these very sophisticated, enduring games. And we do supplement that with outsourcing. So for example, on Jurassic, we did a certain number of the dinosaurs ourselves, and then we start to outsource some of those dinosaurs to third parties. We are also, increasingly with our cash position, we've got about £40 million on the balance sheet right now. We're looking at other models, maybe acquisitions, maybe commissioning. So that could be working with a studio who is still in that work for hire model, and essentially we pay them to develop a game for us over a period of time. So, and acquisitions as well. So third party publishing, commissioning, acquisitions, those three models look quite interesting. We've got nothing to announce now, but we wanted to put that message out there in part to kind of encourage inbound requests. And you know, we are talking to a few people about some of those different models. Now, this is an important one. In terms of franchise announcements, I know you all desperately want to know what the fourth franchise is and probably what the fifth one and the sixth one and the seventh one. And we're not deliberately kind of keeping information from you. Whenever we reveal one of these games, it's got to be with the full marketing power behind it. It's got to have a launch video. It's got to have all the marketing collateral. It's got to have an influencer program. We need it to be a big proper launch so it grabs the media attention, it grabs the community and the players' attention. Ultimately, so that when it does release and when that game is available, it's as successful as it can be. The worst kind of announcement we could do is just to pop a game title at the bottom of an RNS. So we're not deliberately trying to withhold information from you guys. We just want to make sure that the marketing launch plan is absolutely our priority. And then behind that, we'll say what we can. If you look at what we did with Jurassic, we revealed that we'd got a license with a major Hollywood studio. And then by the time we actually told everyone what it was, we had launch assets, we had a marketing plan, we had a lot of stuff around that to really start to build that excitement. Because really that's the start of your kind of sales activity. The other point I just make is that the Jurassic IP has been absolutely fantastic for us. But what we've done is build a really amazing game. We built a great game and we've used that IP in a really interesting way. And that's not to say that IP has to be associated with us in terms of every title in the future. But equally, you know, building the great games is what really matters. If you look at Planet Coaster, if you look at Elite Dangerous. And I think a lot of people tend to think that it's film IP that has the kind of golden ticket to success. So we did have a look at the top 100 selling games. So this is PC last year, this is PC first half, this is console. And what's quite telling is that it's original game IP which tends to dominate. Films can be important, and we've used it, I think, extremely effectively, but it's game IP that's important. So in summary, we've got a very strong proven track record in both the business models that we've operated in, both in work for hire and in self-published. We've got three amazing game franchises already out there, all delivering really well. And we have a fourth coming in the next financial year, which I've said is based on our own IP and will launch anytime between June 2019 and May 2020. And we're scaling up to release roughly one major launch per year. Questions?
Why did the finance CFO change?
Why did I come to?
Why was there a why did you come? Why did the previous chap leave?
So I came because I thought it was a fantastic opportunity. I'd been before this. I was a CFO at Xaar PLC, and before that I was at CSR, which is a semiconductor company. So I'd spent about 16 years in technology companies, all in Cambridge. You know, they're fantastic businesses. But what I really like about Frontier is we are directly in, you know, our success is in our own hands. We're selling directly to our customer, our player. We're not one or two or more steps removed, as you tend to be in a B2B kind of sale in technology. So if we make a great game, we'll be successful. And as we build up this portfolio, that's what was really exciting, to have control over our own destiny.
Okay, and I just had sort of one other question. So the original games, is there a tail off? I mean, how does that work? They're not going to stay popular forever, are they? Obviously, the newest game is the most popular, and then how long does that last, sales cycle?
It's quite different by each game franchise and how we support it and the nature of it. So Elite Dangerous, actually, its record year was the last year we just did, because it launched on PlayStation in that year. So the phasing of Elite Dangerous, we did 19 million the first year, then 21, then about 16. Last financial year was 22. So in its fourth year, actually, it had its strongest year. And that was helped by the launch on PlayStation, but also the way that we love and support that game with free content and paid for content as well. So that's probably a little bit unusual. Planet Coaster did about 20 million in its first year, and about 11 million in the second year. So I think that kind of drop off from launch year to second year is probably more reasonable.
And what's the projection for that?
You can look at it in the analyst numbers. I think it's similar to that kind of level, you know, maybe high single digits, that sort of level. But hopefully we can beat that.
Thanks. I'm not a gamer, but what proportion of your sales comes from in-game sales?
So Elite Dangerous, depending on the platform, it can be as high as 30%. So that's good for a number of points. So first of all, that means that the majority of revenue on Elite Dangerous still comes from people coming fresh to the game, which I think is very encouraging. But Elite Dangerous revenue last year, in terms of total PDLC, so total kind of vanity items, so ship kits, sunglasses, different kind of lasers, things like that, was over 4 million. So, you know, quite encouraging.
You've had the investment from Tencent, from the Chinese. Is that going to sort of result in any development with them or market, you know, markets attacking the Chinese market?
So they're obviously a massive player in China, and we really felt that we needed a strategic partner to help us in China. We're already doing very well in China, selling through a platform like Steam that goes in via Hong Kong. But we are quite interested to have a Chinese partner to really explore other opportunities. And of course, they have their Wii game platform. So I think it's reasonable to assume that at some point we'd look to have games on the Wii game platform.
Can you just tell me what the trade-off is between launching a new franchise and in-game content? I mean, Elite Dangerous, for example, so you say you're constantly looking after the community, but where's the decision between continuing to deliver that or hold it back and for Elite Dangerous 2?
Yeah, that's a tough decision, and it's a constant... it's a constant discussion in the company about how we allocate our resources. We have over 400 people now, probably over 300 development staff, and making sure that we're allocating them to appropriately across the franchises, but also across the work within the franchises, you know, can be quite challenging. But point number one, you know, we think these games have a lot of legs in terms of their revenue over many years, so we will continue to love and support them. Elite Dangerous probably takes a bit more in terms of the free content. Certainly this year we're releasing this major series called Beyond, and the fourth chapter is coming relatively soon, and that's taken up, you know, quite a lot of our development effort. But we think that helps and benefits the long term, even if it doesn't generate revenue directly because it's not a chargeable product.
Hi there. Do you see any material opportunities to outsource your PC console games to others to develop the smartphone tablet markets?
I think there is opportunity there. If you look at the nature of the sophistication of the games and the control mechanism, I think putting those onto mobile and tablet initially does look challenging, but I certainly think there is some opportunity there. Maybe some aspects of the game or the whole game in a slightly different format. So if you look at Planet Coaster, for example, the piece by piece building at the moment, you know, that's why it's really well suited to PC. Could we do a version that would be appropriate for mobile tablet? Perhaps. But back to the point earlier, it's a question of prioritizing the resource and making sure we put people onto the things that we think are going to give us the best return over the long term.
It was interesting, the slide that you put up about the relationship between the game and films and the success tying that in with Jurassic. And you seem to have headed off the speculation that the game in progress is associated with a film, which may be delayed because of delays to the film, because there was some speculation about that as to what the film was. Now that you're growing such a large workforce, how do you prevent a rogue employee spilling the beans before you're ready to actually do all the proper marketing around the launch?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge at any creative company where they're trying to keep something under wraps. I'm sure it's the same in the film industry. You know, we do have strongly worded employment contracts and things like that, but ultimately it's about trust and engagement with the staff, you know, that they understand the importance of keeping things under wraps and not revealing things, and they take it extremely seriously. And you know, back to the question about why I came to Frontier, people love games who work at Frontier, and they love Frontier. You know, what they do every day is what they love. You know, they tend to go home in the evening or even play games at lunchtime, and so they're very, very committed. perhaps a bit too long. You know, they're very committed, and you know, I think we need to trust them.
For better understanding your values and your philosophy as a company, in the long term, could you mention one or two competitors you like to see, like, in the future, in the long term?
Okay. So I think the question was sort of, who do we admire and who do we think aligns quite well with us? I certainly think a company like Paradox is quite similar to us in many ways. So they tend to have this franchise play where they launch and they really then sustain and nurture and kind of look after the game. Our chief creative officer always says, if you look after the game will look after you. And I think they're a company that tends to have that kind of philosophy. Not to say that the others don't, but I think some of the big guys are looking for that massive kind of launch success. And it would be very, very difficult for them to sort of sustain and nurture and love a community where they've had 25 million units. You know, that's going to be very challenging.
Just going to Tesco's, I see Red and Dead and at the counter shelves and all these other games. How are you actually going to reach the market if you don't have a game that's backed by a film like Jurassic? It seems, in your financial thing, you didn't seem to spend a lot on the game, like 7 or 8 million. How are you actually going to make a potential global hit or a niche hit if you're up against these guys that are spending way more on marketing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of those guys are spending a lot on marketing, but I would argue they're not always being terribly efficient. So our marketing, I think, is very efficient. We tend to be very, very focused on digital. So we'll be essentially chasing people around the internet, making sure that they are seeing our game on as many sites as they look at. And if you look at a platform like Steam, that is not just where someone goes to buy their game, but it's the first thing that they log into, and they see what their friends are playing, they see what the news is, they see what messages are coming through. And so our partnerships with people like Steam, with Sony and Microsoft are extremely important in terms of our marketing. So with Jurassic, actually, we probably spent more on, or almost as much on, that physical presence at E3, which was that major electronic show as we did on digital marketing, and yet we managed to reach, you know, this massive audience. So I think in answer to your question, we think we can be pretty smart, pretty targeted, pretty efficient with our digital marketing programs. The other thing I'd add is the influencer program we did on Jurassic was very, very effective. So that's where we engage with probably the top 20, 25 Twitchers, bloggers, YouTubers who are interested in this sort of space, this sort of game genre. And they will tend to have 10 million plus followers. And we invite them to kind of come and play the game. We then release content. They release their content at the same time. And it's a really good way of amplifying our message, much better than just having our kind of marketing video releasing on our website. You have 25 videos, which all look and feel quite similar, all releasing on the same time, all going to this massive number of followers. So, you know, and that doesn't really cost that much.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.